BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Vanley Burke. He is known as the godfather of black British photography. It was as a 10-year-old boy in rural Jamaica that he first picked up a camera. The Kodak Box Brownie was a gift from his mother, a member of the Windrush generation who'd left her homeland for Britain. In 1965, at the age of 14, he followed her and immediately began to put his camera to good use, capturing the lives of the community surrounding him in Handsworth, Birmingham. His desire from the start was to document history from the inside as it happened. He says, "I remember realising that all history had to start somewhere and that we were at a unique stage of history in this country. I was fortunate enough to be witnessing the arrival of a new group of people." His award-winning images have chronicled the lives of his subjects and the history they are part of ever since. Vanley Burke, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Good morning and thanks for having me.
You've said that your aim is not to hold on to the past, but to document the past for future generations. Why is that important to you?
Well, I think as a group of people, we need to be in charge of our history. History is a byproduct of life, and it will be written whether we participate in the process or not. And I felt as a group of people who are living this history, it is important that we get involved in documenting. And as a photographer, I felt it was a good way of writing, helping to write this history.
So you knew, even as a young man, that when you were picking up your camera, you were going to capture something special.
I just thought to myself, here I am witnessing, if you like, or being able to see the arrival of people coming from the Caribbean to this country, and how fortunate I am to do that, because I think, well, what will happen 2,000 years from now? And I thought the least I could do is to document that as much as possible. And so the idea was to photograph everything between birth and death, really.
And as well as photographing, you are a collector. And your collections reflect, I think you've described it as what is beyond the frame.
The collection consists of numerous pieces of material I've collected over the years. Pamphlets, leaflets, magazine, book jackets, clothes, suitcases, anything that resonates with the community, with a history, that have a story attached to it, I collect.
I saw some photographs and I noticed an enviable stash of vinyl in the flat.
Yes.
How big a part of your life is music?
It is very big, really, but no more so than anything else that I've done. You see, all of this is an attempt to acquire, to capture, to retain as much material I can find for future generation to reference. I have quite a few students from time to time who would write to use material from the archive, and that is the purpose that it was intended, really, for it to inform future generation about, you know, a lived experience.
Well, with that in mind, tell me about your first piece of music today.
The first piece of music it's a field recording which was made in rural Jamaica. And in particular, where I live on the foothills of Blue Mountain, quite rural, I remember going to this place, John Field, where there was a mission hall where this sort of music would be sung. And there's a lot of grunting in the process. And for me, it is one of the earliest links with the African experience, in which I've heard so much about as a child. So this is a piece of field recording.
I just see.
A field recording of Jamaican revival music. Vanley Burke, all of human life is in your photographs, from birth to death, via celebrations, protests, religious worship and day trips. Tell me a little bit about the people that you photograph.
The people are ordinary people who came from the Caribbean in an attempt to improve their life chances, really. And I think initially most people came here from the Caribbean for 5 years. And the reason was the duration of the passport was 5 years, and they felt that they could improve their lot and return within that time. So the idea was to go back to Jamaica, really. I mean, they initially came here because of the state of the Caribbean at the time, in particular Jamaica. You know, agriculture was quite poor. I mean, the people needed work, and there were quite a few people, including my grandfather, went to America to pick fruits and work on the farm and then come back, and, you know, they'd probably pay for an extension of the house or buying land or whatever is necessary. And I think with America closing the door at the time and England asking for people to come after the Second World War, then, you know, it seemed an obvious thing to do, because quite a few of these people had served in the Second World War, and it's the return of those people that brought about the Windrush.
You've spent your life documenting the lives of people around you in the barber's shop, the cafe, a funeral, at church. And some of the subjects recur in your work, the individual subjects, including the boy at the centre of one of your most famous images, the boy with the flag, which shows a young boy on a homemade bicycle with a Union Jack flag flying from the handlebars. Tell me about the pictures that you took of him, Winfred Fagan.
I had recently bought a camera, and I was desperate to start taking photographs. So I would go out after my chores on Saturdays and go out and look for photographs to take. And I was walking in Handsworth Park on this Saturday morning, and I saw him riding in the park coming towards me. And I thought, wow, it was just incredible to see this young man with his bike adorned with this flag and riding with his dog running behind him. So I asked him if I could take a photograph of him, and fortunately agreed. And again, quite fortunately, after I composed the shot, the wind blew in the right time and the flag stood up, and the photograph, it's been used numerous times, many book covers and debates. It's got a life of its own and continue to do so.
And later you took pictures of Winfred Fagan at his son's funeral.
Yes, yes. I'm very much in touch with the people I photograph. I live as part of the community that I photograph, and I'm very much aware of what's happening around me. And I heard his son was shot. And he said if he was going to allow anyone to take the photograph, it would be me. And, you know, I duly went along and took some photographs at the funeral of his son. Yeah.
Vanley Burke, it's time for some more music. Tell me about your second disc.
Coming from the foothills of the Blue Mountain, I've decided that Burning Spear, Man in the Hills would be an appropriate choice.
Come along, my brother, come along. Let us do the things we're supposed to do for our mother. Come along, my sister, come along too. But if we should live up in the, 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 live up in the,
and if we should live up in the,
and if we should live up in the,
Burning Spear, Man in the Hills. Vanley Burke, you were born in St. Thomas, Jamaica,
yes,
in 1951. And after your mother moved to Britain to train as a nurse, you were raised by your maternal grandparents. What was family life like for you?
It was wonderful. All children had a chore. Mine was sweeping the house or the yard, but it was wonderful. Played with friends.
Rural, isolated,
very
no electricity.
Rural, very rural. I describe where I come from as if you get on an aeroplane to the country, the plane doesn't go beyond that point, and you get in a car, and then it comes to the end of the road, then you get on a donkey. And when the donkey can't go anymore, I live just around the corner. So it is very rural, but absolutely beautiful. I mean, we're literally on the top of the hills in some of the foothills. We're from Cedar Valley area, so we could see some distance away.
Your grandparents farmed, didn't they?
Yes, they did. It's a family farm, and they grew cash crops, which my grandmother would take to the market. And we used to look forward to her coming back, because it was only then that we would have sweets. I mean, kids eat sweets now and their tongue goes red. We used to eat beetroot. Quite healthy.
The first photograph of you, which I have seen, is taken outside. You're very formally dressed. You've got a white shirt and tie on, very serious expression on your face. And you're resting your hand on a table with a vase and some flowers on it. Who took it and why?
It's a local photographer who would turn up once a week, I think normally on a Sunday, and walk around the community and ask if anyone wants a photograph taken. And these photographs were sent to England to inform the family of how you look in the trousers that they recently sent to you, things like that. And this was outside our house in Maley, up in the hills, and the table was taken outside and it was made to look like a studio shot, really. And this is similar as well to the photographs that would be sent back to Jamaica, where people would dress up, you know, in their, we call Sunday best. Men working in factories and so on would have gloves on and tied, would sit beside the telephone and the table. It's an attempt to show success or progress that they've made. But sometimes the telephone, you could see the cord, it wasn't plugged into anything really.
But the photograph in that context, very powerful.
It is very powerful, yes.
The first camera you ever owned was a gift from your mother. Do you remember the box brownie? What do you remember?
I remember it very well. I remember opening the yellow box. I remember the smell of it. We don't have any technology where we're from. All our toys we made ourselves. But this would be in one of the many parcels that were sent back to family in the Caribbean. And this is normally on a birthday, Christmas, or occasions like that. And in one of these occasions, I received this box brownie camera. As I said, the smell of it, the look of it, and also I was fascinated by the science of it. How did the image get from there to here? And I remember when I eventually had some lessons on how to use the camera, it was keep the sun behind you and don't press the shutter, squeeze it. And I've remembered it, obviously, you know, ever since.
Vanley Burke, tell me about your next disc.
My third is My Boy Lollipop, Millie Small. I remember this very much when I came to England. You know, it was a very much talked about record, and it linked, you know, the whole Jamaica experience with here. So My Boy Lollipop, Millie Small.
Millie Small, My Boy Lollipop. Vanley Burke, at 14, you arrived in the UK. Now, your mother had married by this time, and you had a stepfather and four brothers. So a new country and pretty much a new family to adjust to. How much of a culture shock was it?
It was a fairly big shock, really. I mean, prior to coming here, we were told about cold and snow and fog and, you know, all of this sort of thing. And it's, how am I going to live in this cold place that I hear about? I desperately wanted to get away from Jamaica. You know, it was like a wish come true, really. But as it happened, prior to leaving, I'd gotten on the aeroplane only to be sent back because they had lost my passport. So, you know, just when you thought you'd escape, you just sent back.
So hang on, you got on the aeroplane and then had to get off the aeroplane.
I had to get off the aeroplane. And not only that, I'd been given a bottle of coconut oil to take to my family in England. And I think the bottle had broken and they didn't know about it. So I had to deal with all of that, amongst other things, when I got back.
And you're travelling on your own.
I'm travelling on my own. And 2 days later, we had, I think it would have been a telegram in those days to say that, you know, I could travel. So coming to England was, for me, I think like a lot of people's experience I've heard about, where I come from is very rural. So therefore, when you arrive here and you see all these buildings with smoke coming out of them, you know, these houses we thought were factories.
Your parents ran the shop in Handsworth, just beyond Birmingham city centre. Now, obviously, the local shop is the hub of a community. What was yours like?
It was a really wonderful place to hear the experiences of and lives of the people who were around. It's where they would talk about their experience in the factory, in the church. And arriving, you know, at the shop, again, it was a shop. It was small. It's my first experience of having an upstairs, downstairs, the back garden, really. You look out and there was no green at all. It was just houses. So it was a bit of a culture, colour shock.
And what was the community itself like? Who was around you?
It was a mixed community. There were quite a few English, Irish, not that many people from the Indian subcontinent at that stage. But, you know, you'd get the racism. You know, you'd have a situation where one family would move in a street and the white neighbours on either side would move out. I think ghettos, as they're referred to, are not really made by the people who move in there. They're made by the people who move out of these places, really. Having said that, I'm not by any means suggesting that all white people were aggressive towards. There were friends of my family who were white as well. And my mother, in her album, she has many friends who seen playing in the snow with when she came here to study to become a nurse who were white as well. So it's just the majority of people that we encountered, there was this friction.
Time for some music. Vanley Burke, tell me about your fourth disc.
My fourth disc is in relation to all that was happening at the time, you know, the sus laws, where the police would stop and search individuals in the street without reason. And obviously this annoyed a lot of people who were going about their lawful business. And it, you know, in many areas, it erupted into violence. So I've chosen Linton Kwesi Johnson's Sonny's Letter. Sonny's Letter is a letter being written from a son living in England to his mother in Jamaica about his experience at the hands of police.
Them thump him in him belly and it turn to jelly. Them lick him pan him back and him rib get pop. Them lick him pan him head but it tough like lead. Them kick him in him seed and it started to bleed. Mama, I just couldn't stand up there and do nothing. So me joke one in him eye and him started to cry. Me thump one in him mouth and him started to shout. Me kick one pan him shin and him started to spin. Me thump him pan him chin and him drop on a bin and crash and dead.
Linton Kwesi Johnson and Sonny's Letter. Vanley Burke, you were part of a growing West Indian community in Birmingham that was much discussed in the media at the time. How much of what you heard and read reflected your own experience?
Very little, really. I mean, we heard about disease-ridden people living in an overcrowded house, you know, stealing our jobs and our women, lazy, you know, and all of these negatives. And I wasn't experiencing that. So that also, you know, propelled me to that, you know, we need to document our own history. We need to hear our own voice. So definitely that influenced me somewhat.
And what about the generation gap between you and your parents who were part of that early Windrush generation? You know, how wide was the gap and the difference in attitudes between those sets of people?
Well, a lot of the older generation, I think, came and they thought that if a young person came and told them, you know, I'm being racially abused at school or by the police or by any of the institutions around, they wouldn't necessarily believe them. Their attitude is that there is no smoke without fire. And you must have done something wrong for this to happen. It wasn't until much later on that a lot of people realized that, you know, their children were being picked on, really. And for many, by then, it was too late because there was a lot of brutality. You know, a lot of people died at the hand of racists, you know, racism and racists in this country. You know, in police cells, a lot of them would be put in mental institution, we hear about. But that's been going on for a long time. So, yes, a lot of people have been really, I have to say, brutalised by the system.
And at the time, who were you taking your photographs for?
I don't know. I mean, I talk about I'm photographing for the people, but I really don't know if I could identify them. I just felt the need, you know, compelled, if you like, to document these things. And it wasn't always easy photographing the community. And you know? I've been threatened a few times in the process. But I just felt that, if you like, I knew best, you know, and you will come around to seeing what I'm trying to do. So I remember when times got a bit tough later on, I thought to myself, what would happen if I were to take all my negatives and publicly took an ad out in a few choice press and say, well, Van der Berg will be destroying all his negatives in Hansworth Park on 12 o'clock on the 14th of whatever month? Who would respond to that? And I remember telling a young man this, and he said, they're not yours to burn. And for me, that solved the whole question. I needn't ask anymore. It wasn't necessarily that I wanted to destroy them, because I still knew the value in them, but I just wanted to question the whole process of why am I taking these images and what are their purpose and who is aware of them and who will be involved with their use.
Van der Berg, tell me about your fifth disc.
My fifth disc is Haile Selassie's speech to the United Nations in 1963. I recently used this speech in a piece of work I did at the MAC in Birmingham, Beyond Windrush, where I say I squeezed the air out of it. I took out all the spaces, all the punctuation marks, all the capitals, and just presented it in a block form.
Why is this speech important?
It's important for me because it tries to challenge the whole notion of racism by major powers, the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior. It's also the speech that Bob Marley's song War was based on, but I wanted to go back to its source. It's still relevant today with all that's happening, you know, around the world, perhaps more so than it was then.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, until there are no longer first-class and second-class citizens of any nature, that until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, that until that day, the dream of lasting peace and world citizenship and the rule of international morality will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. And until the ignoble and unhappy regimes that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique and in South Africa in subhuman bondage have been toppled and destroyed, until bigotry and prejudice, malicious and inhuman self-interest have been replaced by understanding and tolerance and goodwill, until all Africans stand up and speak as free human beings, equal in the eyes of all men, as they are in the eyes of heaven, until that day, the African continent will not know peace.
Haile Selassie speaking at the UN in 1963. Van Lieberg, how did you go about becoming a photographer? Did you have a darkroom?
Yes, I started by... I built a darkroom at my grandparents' house. They'd recently purchased a house in the Los Hills area, Birchfield area, and I'd converted the old outside coal house into a darkroom. My uncle helped me to put electricity and water in it, and I would spend numerous hours in there doing photography. But I'd also go to evening classes to learn photography. And later on, I worked and I went to the School of Photography in Birmingham. But I spent a lot of time, you know, in the dark room, you know, while friends were going to parties and so on. I'd be in there in the wee hours of the morning trying to understand how photography works or trying to take that perfect image.
Having left school, you took a job as a studio attendant at Birmingham College of Art and Design. So it wasn't possible to make a living from your photographs at the time.
No. I tried the idea of going around to houses, you know, taking photographs. But my parents really, my mother in particular, didn't want... She thought, well, photography was something you do in your spare time. Really, you know, you need to do a job. What about engineering or something like that? And I would go around to people's houses and take photographs. They'd come to the shops and invite me to take photographs of them and their family. But I soon knocked that on the head because when I took the photograph, to deliver the photograph and to collect my money, I was told, can you come back next week? The paraffin man has just come and they've just paid the paraffin man. So can you come back next week? And that went on too often. So I decided, you know, I'm not going to be doing this.
The paraffin man's always going to be prioritized
over
photography.
Rightfully so. And so I just decided I was going to concentrate on taking the photographs. But fortunately, none of my family has ever said you need to get a proper job. You know, they've always supported what I've done.
And when do you know it's time to put the camera down?
It's never a time to put the camera down. That's when you can't lift it up. I don't always succeed, but I try to take a photograph every day.
Van Lieberg, tell me about your next disc.
The next disc is Miles Davis' Blue in Green. just a wonderful, gentle music you can relax to. And if you drink rum, you can have a rum and coconut water, you know, too. Beautiful music.
Yes, please. Miles Davis, Blue in Green. Van Lieberk, you exhibited a Windrush-inspired installation, 5,000 Miles and 70 Years, at the Mac in Birmingham earlier this year. Now, you're the son of one of the Windrush generation, and of course, controversy over incorrect deportations of Windrush citizens has been making headlines all year. You must have been following the story very closely. Mm. How do you feel about it all personally?
But for the grace of God, go I, really, because I'm one of those people. Fortunately, I happened to have applied for citizenship when it was asked, and I was exempted. But I've met a number of people who since told me that they were caught up in the whole event. A gentleman whom I hadn't seen for some time, I noticed him recently at our local shopping centre, and he told me that he was in Jamaica for some years. He was unable to return to England, and he was just able to, because of the recent controversy, he was given leave to come back to England. You know, if you can imagine, it's just being told you can't go back, you can't work. The ability to use the national health facilities to work, to gain mortgage, to have a bank account, it affects every aspect of your life. So, you know, these people have been traumatized, really. It's quite shocking.
And, you know, how do you feel as a British citizen watching that happen?
Well, I'm incensed by it all, really, as a number of, you know, fair-minded thinking people would be. You know, it's particularly horrific to treat people who were invited, if you like, to contribute. And many of them, you have to remember, paid their own fare to come here to fight the war. And there was a collection around the island to buy Spitfires to fight in the Second World War. And they came and they contributed with their lives, and they've really developed this country in many, many respects. And to find that then you're being, you know, shoved on the scrap heap, you know, it's a bit disheartening.
You're described as the godfather of Black British photography and have said in the past that people are desperate to see themselves. Are they still, do you think, or is social media helping to change things and to redress that balance?
No, I say people are desperate to see themselves reflected in the society and see their contribution to the society that they live in, the communities that they live in. I think I've been very fortunate in that I've hit upon something that resonates with the people that I photograph. So they're quite keen to see what I'm doing and what I've done. And, you know, for all the exhibitions that I've had, there is this eagerness to see and to share that experience with other people.
Time for some music, Van Lieberk. Tell me about your seventh disc.
The seventh one is Nina Simone, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. I've loved Nina Simone amongst many other artists, but she was exceptional. And this one for me is really, you know, what is it to be free? What is it to spend a whole day without thinking about race? You know, what is it to spend, if you like, hours without thinking about it? What would life really be like? You know, if that is freedom, what is, how would it be? And I'd really love to experience that. I don't think I might, though, but, you know, I do like her rendition of this.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break
all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Nina Simone, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Vanley Burke, I know you see your mum every day and you cook for her. Is it true that you take food from your own allotment?
Yes, a few years ago, my friend Claudette Holmes, she had an allotment and she invited a number of us to come and share the allotment with her. And she moved on to somewhere else and it's now my allotment. So, yes, I grow vegetables. It's where I go to do my thinking, really.
How green are your fingers?
Very green. You have to remember that I come from a rural, you know, and farming would have been my next choice of career had I stayed in the Caribbean. And I love growing things. All our vegetables in the summer I grow and I give to friends and family. And we cook and eat. The pumpkins are wonderful. Tomatoes are wonderful this year. Everything is not too bad.
Time for our final piece of music, Vanley Burke. What's it going to be?
The next disc is Leo Graham, Not Giving Up. And I remember during the hard times, you know, when all of this photography documentation and archiving was a big struggle, you know, it helped me through some dark moments. I just needed something, if you like, to propel you along. You know, you're not making the progress you thought you should be making at the time. And it does pull you along, push you along and jolly you up and tell you, you know, just get on with it, really.
Although it's rough, although it's tough, I'm not giving up. Although it's rough, although it's tough, I'm not giving up. Life can't be this way all day. It shouldn't be so rough. It shouldn't be so tough. No, no.
Leo Graham and Not Giving Up. Vanley Burke, I'm about to cast you away into lonely isolation on your very own desert island. But having discussed your tenacity and resourcefulness and lately your green fingers, I get the feeling you might be all right. What do you think?
I'd like the experience.
You'd like it?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I like challenges.
Would you get lonely?
I might do, but, you know, I'd try to form a relationship with the animals around, try to get a parrot or something you can teach him whatever language you speak.
And of course, you're going to be a fair distance from your archive. What about collecting?
I'd find something to collect. Perhaps collect seashells, make things from seashells, coconuts. You know, I'd find something to do.
You will, of course, find the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare waiting for you there. You can also choose another book to take with you. What's it going to be?
I think the Encyclopedia of Tropical Plants. It's how to identify and to grow them. And what more would you need on a desert island?
You can also take a luxury with you, something that will make the time on the island more pleasurable. What would you like?
A machete and a crocus bag.
Machete and a crocus bag. What is a crocus bag?
I identify it as being a rites of passage as a young man. When you've left school and you're given your own field, you have a machete to deal with the land and a sack which is used to put stuff in, stuff you might harvest. It's a Hessian sack.
Haven't you painted on those in the past?
I have done. You've done your homework well. Yeah, they resonate with the history of the people and my experience and the lives of the people who immigrated from the Caribbean. So yes, I've sought them out and painted on them.
I have one last thing to ask of you, Vanley Burke. If you could only keep one of your fabulous tracks today, which would it be?
It would be Miles Davis' Blue and Green. You know, at the end of a long day cultivating the island, it's something to come and listen to. So I would definitely take Miles Davis' Blue and Green.
Sublime choice. Vanley Burke, thank you so much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you very much. I've listened to Desert Island all my British life, and I didn't dream that I'd be sitting in this chair. Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Vanley Burke. Many photographers have been cast up on the island's sandy shores, including David Bailey in 1991, Sam Taylor-Wood in 2005, and Rankin, who spoke with Kirsty Young in 2013. Eve Arnold, the first American woman to be a member of the famous photographic cooperative Magnum, talked to Sue Lawley in 1996.
Your photography is self-taught, isn't it, Eve? You've never really had any professional training.
Oh, I had 6 weeks of training at the New School for Social Research under Brodovich, who was the great hero of magazine art direction.
This was in New York?
In New York.
Just 6 weeks?
6 weeks. It was given at a school called New School for Social Research.
How did you get on?
Well, the first day that I went to the class, I brought some pictures with me. Brodovich had told the class that we were all going to criticize each other's work. And the class was just savage with me. My work was not very good. It was very much camera club kind of thing. And I left that class determined that I would never go back. However, I was too intrigued with what the assignment that was given us was, which was for the following week, we were all to go out and photograph a fashion shot. And I wasn't interested in fashion, but I dug up a group of fashion models in Harlem. And it was really quite incredible because this was in the 50s when you couldn't place a magazine article in a white magazine about a black. But I was intrigued with these young women. It was before the civil rights movement became very heavy in the States. And these women in Harlem were sewing their own clothes, designing them. It was at once an attempt to go their own way and also an attempt to turn their backs on 7th Avenue and the rag trade in New York. And I photographed there, came back with the pictures to the class of one of the models called Fabulous. Her name was Charlotte Stribling, but she called herself Fabulous. And Brodovich, who was giving the class, decided that these were fine pictures and I was to go back and continue photographing, and I went back for over a year.
But what was so extraordinary about them?
Well, these were the days when people worked mainly in studios and everything was beautifully lit and retouched and organized. And these were simply documentation and recordings of what was going on.
It was kind of reportage.
A reportage with no additional light. Everything as was.
And the models moving, not posed?
No. The models moving instead, you know, preparing and putting on their makeup and their wigs and doing whatever they were doing.
But was it so very different in terms of the image? I mean, I've seen the pictures you're talking about, and Fabulous was kind of sashaying towards you, wasn't she, with these wonderful clothes on?
Well, she was in motion.
Yeah.
And that was not what happened. You would always say, hold it. If you were in a studio and photographing a model, it was always posy, it was always contrived. Whereas this was natural. And because I didn't know it shouldn't be done that way, I did it my way.
So it was available light. You were off the tripod, it was handheld, was it?
Handheld.
Which was incredibly avant-garde, really, wasn't it?
Yes, but it's now gone into the visual language, that kind of thing.
Eve Arnold speaking to Sue in 1996. There are over 2,000 more wonderful castaways housed in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue. You can download all our podcasts and listen wherever you want. Next time, my guest will be Hella Pick. She'll be 90 next year and spent 35 years as a journalist with The Guardian. She was witness to some of the key events and interviewed some of the pivotal figures of the past century. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, I'm Matthew Price, and alongside Tina Dehealy, I host the Beyond Today podcast from the BBC. Each weekday, we're going to be tackling some of the biggest news stories with help from some of the best and most informed journalists in the BBC. It's the news podcast that jumps right in to give you that little bit more. So make sure you head over to the BBC Sounds app, search for Beyond Today, and subscribe. And if you'd like to join in the chat, use the hashtag BBC Beyond.